down in the
emergency for the first time in about
this jet. And
receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 1376.1K0710, certificate number 35410. Uranium cubes.
You know how much I like talking about nuclear power, nuclear things.
I mean, it's been only a couple months since we put the nuclear merchant vessel into the Omnibus.
Yeah. I think, and you know how much I like talking about the Nazis of World War II fame.
So your perfect show would have Nazis and nuclear power.
Yeah, well,
if only there were such a topic.
That's the thing. It's like a podcasting. There's a version of typecasting, and I'm particularly susceptible to it because I'm such a... it would be hard to typecast you as a podcaster because... You're a cipher. You're just sort of an invisible man.
No, I would say a polymath. So well versed in everything.
Yes.
That it's hard to specialize.
Whereas I, just by the nature of my gruff voice, am confined to talking about 60s wool clothes and...
I like how you actually hate all that stuff, but it's the timbre of your voice that has forced you into it.
Basically.
What a sad lot. I'm going to have to just hang out at Filson a lot.
Well, I can't anymore.
They're moving.
Well, they're moving production to California, which is like stunningly unself-aware. Like, what is the...
Don't they know that's their only thing now?
Like 80% of the people that buy Filson clothes are doing it just because of the connection to the gold rush. There's no... Move it to California, you might as well be the Gap, which I think is what they're... corporate masters are trying to do.
Well, I assume they're not saving that. If they're trying to save money, you're not going to move to Ojai or wherever their plant is.
Vietnam. There's a lot more garment makers people that are sewers, professional sewers in California than there are here.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, American Apparel used to make all their stuff in America, but it was just because they had sweatshops in Southern California.
I see. So they're taking advantage of a vulnerable population.
That's exactly what it is.
Good job, Filson.
And the thing about Filson is that if they're going to charge $250 for a shirt, like fully $150 of that has to be provenance. And I guess the $15 an hour you're paying somebody up here, some vulnerable sewer up here.
So American Apparel used to be American.
Yes.
I had no idea. And now it's American in the sense that...
They got busted because their owner was a pervert.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he was terrible.
I just assumed it was American in the sense now that we've actually put it on shelves in America.
Right.
That's what makes it American. Straight from Bangladesh.
It appears in America.
Yeah. At some point, it's going to be on an American torso until it wears out next year.
But the thing is, we do, as part of our Patreon, accept listener suggestions. We don't accept listener suggestions from the 50 ongoing threads on various social media of people going, you know, it would be a great Omnibus episode because...
I do make a list. I keep those? Yeah, I keep a list of those. Wait,
well,
you don't look at that list?
No, I intentionally don't. I avert my eyes because I feel like I need to keep the thread pure for people that are you know, doing it the correct way, which is donating to the Patreon.
You're like a magazine that doesn't look at submissions, because then later they could sue you.
That's right.
And say, hey, I said we should do a show about the Yeti first.
That's right. I wrote the script to Coming to America, and somehow it got out. Now I'm suing.
Well, podcasting is it's a comfort food medium, at least in this era. Who knows for the Mantis men listening to this in the year 3000. But right now, it's people who do want to kind of, many of whom want to feel like they know exactly what they're going to get.
Yes.
So they don't mind. They're like, they're not going to be like, oh, why is John talking about Nazis again? They're going to be like, make some popcorn, honey. John's talking about Nazis.
I know. And they don't realize, you know, I've spent in the last week probably 80 hours thinking about digitalis and other local plants that are hazardous if ingested. But I'm not going to do an episode on
it. Why not?
Well, maybe I should. Well, but even that is kind of typecasting.
A 10-part series. Plants. Foxglove.
Yeah. So anyway, you contacted me the other day and you said, here are some listener suggestions, 3 different topics that have to do with early internet, like message boards.
And I knew sending that over, you were not going to know what any of those things were.
I don't know what that is. BBS. I don't care. And then you were like, but what about some Nazis and nuclear energy?
And his other suggestion, Linda Ronstadt's grandfather.
Well, Linda Ronstadt's grandfather is an interesting case, but it's unfortunately there are a lot of show suggestions that end up being kind of a one-note surprise. Like, guess what? Linda Ronstadt's grandfather invented the rubber ice tray.
That's a guy who danced to the beat of a different drum.
Scene, right? There's not...
you don't need a... It doesn't build.
Yeah.
There's no second act.
Yeah, he didn't... I mean, he invented the electric oven, too.
I mean, I'm working on a screenplay that starts with Linda Ronstadt's grandfather inventing the ice cube tray, but then, you know, that's when the communist agents show up.
Well, sure, and that would be a great show.
But it didn't happen.
If it were true. But the thing is, I think it's always interesting when you get to the backstory of someone like Linda Ronstadt and go, oh, there was family money. You know, not that Linda Ronstadt wasn't the first lady of American folk rock in the 70s.
Take that, Carly Simon.
Well.
Carly Simon wasn't dating Jerry Brown, right?
Carly Simon also, she was the, well, actually, let's be honest, the first lady of...
Carole King.
Is Carole King. That's right.
I mean, and maybe Joni Mitchell if you're going to go back that far.
Compared to Carole King?
Also, you said American, so sorry, Joni.
Oh, right. Oh.
North of the border.
No Canadians allowed.
Asterisk. Godfather of grunge. Asterisk if you allow Canadians.
But I think it would be a very interesting... Medium article to just go and really break down how many American rock musicians had a grandfather that invented,
so they could drop out of college.
Yeah,
because we think of that as we decry that as a modern phenomenon, that all these unpaid internships mean that the only way now to get into publishing or fashion or a million other fields is to be able to work for free for a year because mommy's writing a check.
Yeah, there's tons of examples of sort of Beastie Boys or what the heck was that band in the early 2000s from New York where they all looked like not underwear models, they all looked like cool Vice models. They made a great record that was produced by Gordon, who was in The Sky Cries Mary.
There we go. Now we know who you're talking about. Yeah. We all know, so let's not say.
Yeah, what were they called? It's not the Killers,
This would be a good game show. You know, like the elderly person gives you clues, and you're, no, they lived across the street from us.
No, they were these kids that their fathers were all in entertainment.
Right.
And not the Beastie Boys.
Nepo Baby.
Whose fathers were also in entertainment.
I mean, does it count as Nepo Baby if you're... Grandpa invents the ice cube tray.
Like, see, no.
How much of a leg up in the industry does that give you? Like, no. is the guy from EMI like, wait, I love ice cubes. Bring her in.
I have an electric engine. No. I mean, Linda Ronstadt, also a great singer and, you know, and obviously like had a lot of elements of rock star. You know, she was born to trod the board.
But who knows how many of those are reinforced by.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm as pretty as Linda Ronstadt, but I didn't have family money.
No, I mean,
I had a lot of family class, but
that didn't get Jerry Brown bringing you posies.
No, it did not. But of course, so we get a Nazi nuclear power thing, and you just rugby passed it to me. Like, guess who's good at this? And it's true.
I would have done 80s era bulletin boards.
Yeah,
but I feel like we needed more of a hook. Like we needed one weird. bulletin board or subculture, or and I had not yet dug into it.
But this is potentially one of those topics that you would assume at the outgo. Like my daughter and I were
the
at
outgo.
You would assume at the outgo, Led Zeppelin record.
If this word existed, you would assume at that point. What, John?
Well, you know, my sister and I, not my sister. Oh my God, I'm really, so I had COVID recently. The first time I had COVID, you can probably still hear it in my voice a little.
Are you more into wool underwear now that your voice is more gravelly?
I feel very much like I've turned a corner. I just turned 55, which means I can now live in restricted communities like the...
Think of it as a cool Sammy Hagar age. Don't think of it as an AARP milestone.
I'm going to get a golf cart and move to the Villages. Have we done the Villages? That feels like something I should do now.
You want to switch to it right now?
We're
only, what, 12 minutes in?
I mean, I do have a lot of information about the Villages just from, you know, so just
from watching personal interest. Watching Fox News?
Yeah. No, from being a parrot head, you know.
No. R.I.P. R.I.P. Jimmy.
But yeah, so I'm a little scratchy, but I'm also really feeling my age. I'm starting to call my daughter by my sister, you know, I say, Susan, I mean, Mom, I mean, oh, you're my child.
So I've noticed a weird thing where, and this, I've been doing this for decades, so maybe this is not purely senility. It could be part senility, John. But like I've noticed that when I am with, you know, my brother or my son, like I have no problem not screwing up generationally with their names or ages. Right. But when they're both there, I will absolutely say, Nathan. And my wife will do it with her brother too. So clearly Freud was right, and there is some... You know, the mistakes we make do reveal kind of the shortcuts that our neural pathways are forming in order to be like, yeah, you got one cluster of male relatives.
Right.
And luckily they're not usually together, so we don't have to train you on that.
Right.
And then suddenly you start calling your daughter Susan.
Yeah, for sure. I also feel like it's just the outer rim of my brain is just disintegrating into like the foam inside of an old couch. Where it just becomes sort of sand.
We're going to see the springs soon.
Ugh, here we go. But she and I, my daughter and I, were over in Burien, Washington, and we went to the Highline History Museum.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I drove by that.
Yeah.
Why is there a history museum in Burien?
Well, it's one of those history museums, kind of a local, small history museum that only costs $8. And it opens with a giant sloth, like a sloth. That's
like a megafauna sloth.
Yeah.
Which we did on the show.
Right. A big sloth. But they actually found this sloth when they were building the runway at SeaTac Airport.
Oh, it's a skeleton.
It's a skeleton of a sloth. They didn't find a living sloth.
Hey, guys, can you not build the runway through here?
And this is unlike finding an ancient ruin in Athens where they have to stop building the subway for a year.
Because like hundreds of government agencies have to be like, you keep the trinket.
Here what they did was they just pulled the sloth out of the mud and then continued to build the runway. Over what I can only imagine are thousands of other sloths.
Because sloths would go to a communal place to die, probably.
Yeah.
Very slowly.
A party place, right? A sloth party.
The Villages for
They're
sloths.
They're too slow to get out of the way of the glacier is why they died there. They're so big.
I'm trying to think if the glaciers are faster than you're thinking, or if the sloths are slower.
Yeah, I don't know.
Are you just imagining a very fast glacier?
Looking at a skeleton, I can't tell how fast the sloth was, and I don't think any of us know how fast the glaciers came.
Hard to say.
Might have been over the course of a weekend.
Wow.
But so they start with that, and then
imagine the meteorologist?
Whoa, it got cold so fast. Then there's sort of the obligatory, here were the native peoples that lived in this region that we're going to give a name to and have a diorama of two people making a basket.
We can't not have the basket and the dugout.
Yeah, and sort of, you know, a complex intermediary thinking about like, well, are we going to change all the place names to native names? They're very hard to spell.
They have exclamation points and stuff.
Maybe, I don't know what we're supposed to do here, but here's an example.
Let's put in one room.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the sloth. Then here are the Native Americans, and now we're going to talk about SeaTac Airport for 80% of the museum. But that's really what the museum is about. This region, this neighborhood kind of partly sacrificed itself to build this giant airport. And one of the displays there, and it's a local museum, they're starved for displays. One of them was about D.B. Cooper.
Who probably had little Burian connection as far as we
know. None at all. But
his flight originated.
His flight originated at SeaTac. Actually, it originated in Portland, but he got his money here, his briefcase of money. So my daughter is over there kind of fascinated by it, but it's a dark room for no reason except it's mysterious.
This is the spookiest thing that's ever happened in Burian.
And she's like, I want to go in there and read about it, but I, you know, it's a little spooky. And I said, listen, I could tell you the D.B. Cooper story backwards and forwards with one hand tied behind my back. And I realized that that's an example of a thing that we do. I'm sure you could tell the D.B. Cooper story, including all the details, maybe not the date, the exact date, but do you know how much money they dug out of the Columbia River?
I don't. It's not that much. Right? Oh, it's more than I thought.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm actually not that good at narrative like that.
Right.
Like if I were to tell you a movie I saw a month ago, I'd be like, hold on, I can back my way through this. Okay, it ends at a diner. So that must mean in the third act she gets the money to make the diner. Okay, oh right, there's a part with her son. But no, I'm not like
But you could sit right down and I'll tell you a tale in the movie and go down their IMDb page.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'd be doing. Yeah. I'd be like, okay, you know who was in this was
they were in Diner. They were in the background in Diner.
So like I'm seeing like a constellation of facts and trying to reconstruct the arc.
We've talked about this a lot, the different ways that we retain information.
And you're, I think you're the opposite.
Yeah, I
just
have no
all
idea
arc, no facts.
Who was in Diner. Wasn't Ted Danson? Was he in Diner?
No.
No, but a lot of people that looked like Ted Danson.
Yes.
Yes.
Instead of casting Ted Danson, they cast six people, the average of whom
was Ted Danson.
Yeah. You get Kevin Bacon, you get Daniel Stern, you get a bunch of people together and you...
Wow, all those people.
You computer model them and they turn into Ted Danson.
Yes, right. Well, it would seem that the Nazi... pursuit of nuclear power and ultimately a nuclear weapon in the war era would be like the story of D.B. Cooper for me and for a lot of our listeners, a thing we all know backwards and forwards because we've talked about, there have been so many History Channel one-hour presentations.
I mean, this summer alone, between Oppenheimer and Indiana Jones, you got kind of a treatise on Nazis and nukes.
You did, but it's all very... It turned out in looking more deeply at it that the story is not really commonly fully told because it's confusing. It's confusing for people to understand, and it's much easier because there's an entire industry, like an entertainment industry, just based on making us all scared about what the Nazis could have done. If only.
Delivering World War II content to boomers.
Yeah, and all you run out pretty fast of legitimate World War II content, which is, yes, they did horrible things, and also they managed some impressive military victories that lasted a couple of years. And then...
thousand-year Reich.
Yeah,
more like thousand-hour Reich.
Really got their ass handed to them pretty quickly afterwards. I mean, in the United States, we were in Afghanistan for, what, six times longer than the entire... No, not the entire Nazi arc, but...
Here's your testament to American superiority, is that we can lose a war for five or six times as long as the Nazis could lose a war.
Yeah. In fact, every war we've lost since 1962, we've been there longer than World War II lasted.
It takes forever. That's how good we are.
But of course, the story also involves the fact that in the pre-war era, Germany was home to a lot of foundational chemistry and physics, and they were quite a bit, I mean, they were the font of a lot of that science, far surpassing what scientists were doing anywhere else. And it's I mean, the proof is that we had to take all those German scientists.
Right.
Either
if
the
we
Jewish
wanted
ones,
to go to the moon.
Yeah. The Jewish ones that got kicked out before the war, and then all the Germans that we captured at the end of the war.
And it's a plot point in Oppenheimer that he has to go to Cambridge or Oxford, and then they're like, no, 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 no. Like, the real physics is happening over in Germany. You got to go to Heidelberg or something.
Yeah, yeah. The Heidelberg German experiment. The famous Heidelberg German
Heidelberg uncertainty principle. So what you're saying is this is a complicated story with a lot of dead ends and red herrings and stuff, and you thought, that's for me. I'm going to make that a podcast.
I love complicated stories with a lot of red herrings. I think it's one of those, it's maybe in a sense the opposite, which is that the desire to have these stories be complicated, full of red herrings, actually is the industry, and it belies the fact that in a way it's kind of uncomplicated.
It's like six guys or something.
Yeah, and also the reason that they, the reason that the Nazi war machine failed to make an atomic bomb or even a viable reactor is they were never close. They weren't even remotely close. And
so there's no suspense.
Right. And there was no, and in order to have them not make a workable reactor, let alone a bomb, did not require a ton of espionage. There was nobody snuck in the middle of the night and Stuxnetted any centrifuges.
You want skullduggery.
Yeah. And famously, you know, there are a lot of movies about the Allied effort to bomb the heavy water manufacturing facility that was up there in Sweden.
Yeah.
And a lot of the suspense,
as if that were the heroic thing that kept the Nazis from getting the bomb.
That's right. But, you know, heavy water was not going to deliver them a bomb or even a reactor.
Right. It turned out that was the wrong avenue. You needed a graphite pile or something.
Yeah. Well, and so graphite is even worse at...
What?
Well, yeah. So here's, let me explain basically uranium.
Here's how to make a bomb.
Did you know that you can take a uranium cube and hold it in your hand? You can put it under your pillow and sleep on it.
Would a Geiger counter clickety-click?
Yeah, a little. Click, 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 click. But uranium itself is pretty stable.
I mean, it sits in the ground,
yeah,
you know?
It's an element, and it's not particularly radioactive. What makes it dangerous is that it's chemically poisonous. So if you eat it or snort it, highly not recommended. Worse than fentanyl, and it also doesn't get you high. But it's chemically, that's right, it's chemically poisonous. So you don't want to eat a cube of it, but you could absolutely hold a cube of it.
If it gets in your water, it's a bad deal.
And in fact, you can buy it. You can go buy...
Right now?
Yeah, you could buy a little Amazon? Block of... I don't know about Amazon, but you can get a little 2-inch cube of, or a 2-centimeter cube of uranium for about $800.
I had a neighbor kid that was buying... Yeah, you can buy kits. This kid wanted to own everything on the periodic table. He was very excited that his grandma was about to change out the smoke alarms and he was going to get some americium or something, cesium or something when she did.
All those rare earths that are hard to get. But, you know, the hard part is that a couple of those, like gold and platinum, are going to be, to get a 2-centimeter cube, going to be expensive, although uranium's not cheap. But uranium, as it appears in nature, it's uranium-238 is the isotope. And in order to make uranium that is nuclearly fissible,
yeah,
you have to refine it. You have to refine it down to uranium-235, which is the good stuff. But uranium-235 appears in less than 1% of all of the naturally occurring uranium. Like 0.7% of uranium is useful for bombs and reactors.
Okay.
And in order to process it or enrich uranium, it's very hard to do. You have to use a lot of power to do it, and it requires a lot of technology. There are three ways now that you can refine uranium, and one of them is a gas diffusion, where you turn uranium into gas and you run it through it's basically like panning for gold.
Yeah.
You run it through a filter, over and over and over again, and you filter the good uranium you want, the 235 out, and then you have to do it again, and you have to do it again, and it just, it's labor intensive, it takes time, it's extremely expensive to do.
So it really is panning. You're not doing anything to the protons and neutrons to turn U-238 into 235. You just need to filter out all the 238 and get left with the tiny amount of 235 that God put there.
Yeah, that's why the uranium you would buy is what we call depleted uranium. Which is just that they've
taken out the good stuff.
They took out the good stuff. And so depleted uranium is fairly common, and the U.S. government uses it to tip bullets and to put – because it's extreme – you know, it's very dense, heavy metal.
I want to build like an Eames chair out of it.
Well, I think it's now fairly common knowledge that, you know, uranium-238, big chunks of it are in the tails of airplanes as just a heavy counterbalance to keep them
– it's a doorstop basically.
Yeah. Yeah, we use it in a lot of applications. The other way that you can, or the other ways that you can refine uranium, is the centrifuge method, which again is basically just panning. You spin the centrifuge in a certain way
get the heavier stuff out.
Yeah, the good stuff gets out, and the rest of it is in the center. And that's the when I referred to Stuxnet. Are you familiar with the Stuxnet story?
I don't think so.
Well, the Iranians were, they had a whole system where they were trying to refine uranium, and they had centrifuges, you know, a big complex of centrifuges. Because again, you have to do it and then do it again and then do it again, and extremely energy intensive.
Sounds boring.
So boring, and it takes a really long time. So the Iranians were, or Iranians were, depending on whether you learned that word in 1979 or whether you learned that word in 1999.
Iranian hostage crisis.
That's right.
Iranian ambassador. Iranian uranium program.
So, you know, and these centrifuges are spinning very fast. Well, really not that long ago, although I say that as a 55-year-old. If you're a Generation Z listener, it probably happened at the very dawn of your life. Yeah. But all of the Iranian centrifuges at one point all went spinning out of control and demolished themselves because someone, Ken, snuck basically, I think, a thumb drive in that had...
Someone hacked
Iran? That had just a little worm that got in there and told the centrifuges to do something that... you know, to spin slightly faster or slightly in some way.
Is this some rogue scientist who doesn't believe in the mission, or is this espionage?
No, it's espionage. And I think it was one of those things where Mossad or Mossad, depending on whether you learned that from a book
or
from someone saying it out loud, and also the CIA, both disavowed having... developed Stuxnet in such a way that there was, it was clear that they were claiming responsibility. No!
No with eight O's, said a spokesman. Why did you say it like that, sir? No
Who could have done that? But yeah, I think it was pretty sophisticated early example of industrial hacking and the stuff that we're very afraid the Russians are.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's funny when we do it.
Yeah, but if it happened...
If it happens to the 2024 election, we're not so into it.
Exactly. And then there's a new way of refining uranium that uses lasers that's even better.
Now I'm into it.
Even less, it requires less energy. Although making better, easier, cheaper ways to refine uranium is probably not in the global... self-interest long term.
If every big landlocked North African country had one of these programs, I would love it.
Yeah. Well, but you know, there's always a new Stuxnet too. And I personally feel you hear a lot about Russian nuclear capability vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine and their threat to the world.
Yeah.
But I feel like if we Stuxnetted Iran however long ago, Iran however long ago, there's not a single usable Russian warhead. You know, nobody's really afraid. That stuff all, there's so many worms in the vacuum tubes that are running that system.
It doesn't even have to be us. It's probably just, you know, they didn't do the upkeep.
That's what it is. Yeah.
You got to change the oil every 15,000 miles, Russia.
I mean, maybe the only thing that would protect them is the fact that there really are no computer. The computers are all Radio Shack technology and not connected to anything. But even then, it's full of rust. You know, I don't have any. I don't have any doubts that if they tried to launch one of those missiles, it would. It'd be like an early SpaceX launch.
That's a good deterrent. Now there's a 50, Mr. Putin. There's a 50% chance this rocket will just detonate right here in the silo.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, better to just rattle them.
Yeah.
But so the Nazis did not. Not only did they not have the industrial capability to refine uranium in this way, it was not clear yet that was even the path, because there had yet at that point been any kind of controlled fission reaction, right? All of that stuff, the pioneering events, or the landmark events, all happened in the United States.
Chicago. Yeah.
And happened in very short order. And it was largely because the United States and Canada and Britain in their wartime posture were able to marshal in a very cooperative spirit, and the Oppenheimer movie shows that this was not easy to do, but ultimately there was the focus to put all these people together.
And it's a moonshot kind of thing. Yeah, we know we're going to have to set up this facility in Washington, this one in Tennessee. We got this in Berkeley. You know, it was a huge national thing, logistically a nightmare, but it was understood very early that this might be what it takes.
Yeah, Einstein was walking around a pond and having
and his hat blew off, and he was like, "Mein Gott, the Nazis must not get the bomb."
And honestly, it cost an unfathomable amount of money that I don't even know if we can calculate today how much the Manhattan Project actually
cost. I bet they
cost.
Got a good deal.
They probably did. I mean, if you were trying to make
a
bomb,
it'd be way more today.
They did make a bomb.
Yeah.
But also, they made two. That's right.
Three, if you count Trinity.
Two very different, three very different bombs, really. The Fat Man bomb over Nagasaki actually used plutonium, which is a different distillate.
And you couldn't call it that today.
You couldn't call it Fat Man now. No, you'd have to say Body Positive Man.
Thick Boy. Robust.
Thick
bomb.
Boy. Oh, Thick Boy. Oh, I like God. That.
That is going to be in a movie of some future dystopia where the atomic bomb is named Thick Boy.
Yeah. He's a good boy.
We're going to drop Chonky Lad.
Friend, why friend shape?
We're going to drop Chonky Boy and I'm Just a Little Guy on our enemy's two industrial cities.
It's interesting the design of the original bomb, the big bomb. Well, they're both big bombs. Hey, every bomb is a big bomb. But the original bomb, Little Boy, the first bomb, was actually, it used uranium-235, and the design of it was that they shot two pieces of uranium-235 at one another. Yeah. It was called the gun bomb. The plutonium bomb, plutonium is much less stable. It's much more radioactive, and they couldn't do that because the bomb would have fizzed.
Blown up early?
Or just gone crazy chaotic. And that's why they had to have just one piece of plutonium and then they fired a bunch of bullets at it from around it. So what the Germans had was not just the science problem, but which was significant, and we'll talk about it in a second, but they also had the problem of just bureaucracy, and as you know, I go on record all the time saying bureaucracy is the soul of civilization. Bureaucracy is really our greatest strength.
Well, apparently it kept the Nazis from getting nukes. So.
It did, and it keeps the United States burbling along in ways that other countries struggle because
of the deep state.
We do actually have, for the most part, a functional bureaucracy. There's always some office, and it sounds like the movie Brazil, which you could probably name six actors. Name six actors from the movie Brazil.
Jonathan Pryce.
Yes.
Robert De Niro.
That's two.
Kim Greist. Three. Catherine Helmond is in it.
Okay, I don't know who these people are, but go on.
It's getting a little tougher now. Michael Palin's in it.
There it is.
And his boss, Jonathan Pryce's boss, is some little weaselly British man.
Go on.
I don't know. Come on,
you got to get there. Oof. There's one more, a famous one.
Wait, there is?
Yeah, well, I mean, famous.
Who did I forget? Michael Palin.
Bob Hoskins.
Bob Hoskins is the repair guy.
I knew one person in that movie because he's so good in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Who is the boss? I can't.
It's going to be a name. Oh, you know who it is?
It's Bilbo. It's Ian Holm. Because remember how he's like, oh, thank you so much, Tuttle. I couldn't do this without you.
Right.
Buttle, Tuttle.
No, I barely remember that movie. I remember being extremely bored by it in high school. But
it's not too late. You could rewatch.
There is that sense of bureaucracy in the United States as being like dysfunctionally sort of complicated, overcomplicated. But in fact, the fact that you have a place that you can file a form that asks for redress or, you know, and even if it ends up in a basket and then taken to another basket, there is a system. And a
system that even elected officials are very slow to screw up.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons that the attempted coup d'etat that happened in the United States a mere 5 years ago was unsuccessful, largely because they didn't have the right paperwork.
When we started the show, that would have been a bit. The attempted coup that happened in the U.S. 5 years ago, this would have been a dystopian bit. Now we're just like, lol, remember that?
Lol, really happened.
Most of them are still in Congress.
And what was true bureaucratically in Nazi Germany was that that all these different groups were siloed and they were all in competition with one another. The scientists and the chemists and there are theoretical scientists and then experimental scientists. And in the United States, we naturally combined those into a working group, and we actually had a lot of scientists that were both physicists and experimenters, but typically they are different. They're in different camps,
right?
And in Germany, they couldn't cooperate, or they didn't have the money, and a lot of them really the program in Germany. Well, I should say that in 1939, fission was discovered in Germany by German scientists and Austrian scientists.
Like America had to catch up.
Yeah, and at the time it was scary, right? They know all this stuff about it. And in fact, Otto Hahn won the Nobel Prize for physics. Or no, I'm sorry, he was a chemist. Won the Nobel Prize for chemistry during the war. He didn't find out about it until he was in a.
Had he defected? Was he?
Nope.
Was he? Oh
no, he was working for the Germans.
They just gave the during the war. They gave the Nobel Prize to a Nazi weapons engineer.
They sure did. And he
that's
didn't,
a brave move.
He didn't find out. Well, they're Swedish, you know. He didn't find out about it until he was being held captive by the British after the war.
And somebody gave him $1 million check in kroner?
Oh, by the way, and famously, he won it, although the physicist, Lisa Meitner.
Oh, right. Because she was a woman.
Yeah, did a lot of the science and, in fact, kind of directed his attention to what his findings were. And whether
as a good ally, I celebrate the women Nazi scientists.
That's right. Equally. Well, and she wasn't. She actually escaped.
She was Jewish, I think, right?
She was, and she escaped. She lost her Austrian citizenship, and through the kind of complicated machinations of a lot of her scientist friends, she escaped in the middle of the night to the Netherlands and then ultimately to Sweden.
I mean, was this part of the problem with the Nazi war effort? They had this huge brain drain of a lot of their best scientists due to Nuremberg laws?
And yeah, they all came to the United States. But yeah, she was denied the Nobel Prize. She was nominated for the Nobel Prize in physics like between 30 and 40 times and never won it. And yeah, there's a lot of different ways you could tell that story. It would be an amazing movie, except again, extremely boring for the most part.
You lost again, Lisa Leitner.
But what they were trying to do was create a stable fission reaction. And the way that they were attempting to do it was putting a bunch of uranium-238 into a tank of heavy water, the idea being that the heavy water was going to stabilize the uranium fission.
So the reactions keep happening, but nothing dominoes or cascades.
Goes crazy, right. And the difference between heavy water and graphite is the idea that both of these elements were going to be capable of, hopefully capable of containing that fission reaction. Graphite actually would have been worse at
the really?
Job.
So, yeah. Graphite was not the Fermi lab solution. What did we do? I don't even know this.
Well, what we realized was that uranium-238 was never going to have enough reactivity to accomplish this, right? And if the design, the Heisenberg design in Nazi Germany had actually the idea of it, the philosophy of it, or the physics of it, would have been really disastrous if they had had uranium that actually did react with each other.
So you're saying we might not be eating bratwurst today, even if they had switched over?
I think by the time the war happened, bratwurst had been imported to the United States in the form of all those German farmers that came over.
Yeah, but you and I aren't eating it. We're not Midwestern. Czech immigrants.
Do you feel like the bratwurst that you eat here, and or bratwurst, as we would have said back before the Iranian Revolution, do you feel like it's a Nazi innovation?
Maybe I needed to pick a different German culinary.
The stuff that
element.
Came over with the soldiers. You're saying, like for instance, East German microphones.
No, I'm saying Germany wins the war, and we have to have Spätzle and bratwurst every meal.
Oh, ugh.
I'm sorry. That's just how it is. Ugh. That's what they're eating in Universe X, where the Nazis were, the Axis won the war.
In fact, when after the Germans lost and the German scientists were all so I don't know if you know this, but we collected a lot of German scientists in England and put them in a house together.
It's a reality show.
Yeah, called Farm Hall.
That's a good show.
Have you seen this?
Yeah, I saw the first two seasons of Farm Hall.
Farm Hall.
Then later they get the Page Three girls. And
what was funny was rather than interrogate them, they just put them all together in a house and put microphones in the ceiling and let them live there from July of 45.
It's a reality show.
It was like, well, housewives of the rich and Nazi.
It's basically Jean-Paul Sartre's POW camp. Like, we'll let them interview each other.
And we'll have a panopticon.
And hell is other people.
And so they did. They sat there and chatted. In fact, there was one conversation where one of them said, "Do you think there are microphones in here?" And Heisenberg himself was like, "No, they're not they're not that clever. That's like Gestapo stuff."
Wow, it was Nazi that. Propaganda. It was like the West is soft and dumb.
Yeah, soft and dumb. So they wouldn't possibly be making transcripts of all of
where,
our stuff.
It's funny because we never did that. We were like, our adversary is Wiley. Like we did it right. To the point of racism, you know? Like if the Germans had done more of that, like watch out for the cagey American. I mean, they did it famously with their anti-Semitic propaganda. But if they had been more like, watch out for the... For the wily Briton, instead of like, look at these fat cheese eating shopkeepers.
Yeah, well, we made the absolute category error of ascribing to the Soviets a lot of smarts that they didn't yeah, have.
We did it the other way around.
So we spent 60 years like, oh boy, you know, look out for these guys, and they just were, all of their vacuum tubes were made out of cheese. And I mean, cheese factors into this story a lot.
I mean, the Soviet Union didn't get white bread until, you know, well into the 80s.
Do they even have it now?
They dream of it.
Like. But so the design of the reactor that they were working on, and pretty early in the war, they lost all their funding. The scientists were diffused all, and hilariously, a lot of the physics students and chemistry students and graduate students, people that were really working on what could have been a program, when the Germans invaded Poland, they just sort of mass conscripted a lot of those students into the Wehrmacht.
Went to war.
Yeah, so they all got helmets and rifles and private stripes and marched off. So there was really not a sense.
It sounds like the leadership didn't believe in it,
right,
the way the Roosevelt administration did.
They didn't believe in it, and partly that was because of a distrust of
intellectuals, yeah.
Of intellectuals, right? Yeah. And a feeling that all of those, that the fact that there were so many Jewish mathematicians and scientists, that there was already a corrupted...
You're doing this decadent, depraved yeah. math. Stop that.
Exactly. You're friends with a lot of suspicious characters. Whereas here in the United States, of course, there was never any anti-Semitism.
Whew.
And we love to exploit scientists. But the design of the reactor was that they did have a lot of uranium-238, and they formed it into cubes.
Because they didn't know what else to do with it.
Beautiful cubes. They're like 2-inch square cubes. They're like big dice.
Is it something you can show the Fuhrer? Like, how's it going? Well, we have made these.
Look at these beautiful cubes. And then they strung them on cables.
And hung them from their rearview mirrors.
And hung them from the ceiling.
Really?
Yes. And then dipped the whole group of hanging cubes. It looks like a chandelier from Art Nouveau.
Busby Berkeley movie.
Yeah. They
dipped them into fondue.
Dipped it into heavy water. And
but really nothing would have happened if they hadn't dipped them into heavy water, right? Because this is reasonably stable 235.
Yeah, 238.
Oh, sorry, 238.
Yeah, the whole thing it did not work and did not produce results, and eventually they kind of felt like, well, the reason the Germans were so surprised when we actually produced the bomb was they thought that it was a decade away, the science. And
it's like ChatGPT.
In fact, when they were all standing around in Farm Hall and some guy Captain Winters came in with his helmet on and said, "Oh, BTW, we just dropped a nuclear bomb." They all scoffed. Ha ha ha! Oh, this is impossible.
Oh, when he came into Farm Hall?
Yeah, when they heard about it at Farm Hall, somebody came in. I'm sure
they seemed like they were a little French a second ago when Sergeant Winters told them,
"What is the deal here? How can you do this?" No, they were from Alsace-Lorraine. They were Germans, but they spoke with a softer accent. So they didn't believe that it was possible, but,
they weren't close,
but it was like a lot of German stuff, like their uniforms and their tanks and whatnot. It was very beautiful. If you think about the reactor at the University of Chicago, if you've ever seen a picture of it, it's totally ugly.
It's literally under the bleachers of the football stadium.
What a dumb-looking thing. Whereas the Germans made a chandelier out of uranium.
It looks like a Bond villain headquarters. But you know, we're not saying you got to give it to the Nazis, to be clear.
No.
Just because we like the stitching, just because we, you know, just because we're into leather in a Tom of Finland way.
Listen, do not give it to the Nazis, right? And they, you know, they had access to uranium. Interestingly, there's uranium in the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia, which, and the Germans obviously were there.
Or had early, got there early.
Yeah, they did.
That's one of their first things.
They got there in 1300.
But you're saying the Sudetenland is German. I see what you're saying.
Not anymore.
I see what you think.
Did I ever tell you have I mentioned that I walked across Europe?
Did you walk through the Sudetenland?
I did, and at one point, but hilariously, not even in the Sudetenland. I was walking through a remote mountainous region of Romania, mm-hmm. and came upon in a valley, sort of abutted against the Vulcan Mountains, if you can believe that. I found a town that looked like a little Edelweiss-draped Bavarian town.
It was Leavenworth?
It was basically, yeah, Seattle's Leavenworth or Washington's Leavenworth.
It was some little Oktoberfest theme park in the middle of the...
Like a little German town, and I thought, what a strange thing to have here. And I went into the first shop, and there was a blonde woman with braided hair.
Selling cuckoo clocks?
And I said, you know, was ist... And she spoke German, and she said, "This is a German town and has been a German town for 700 years, and the fact that it's in Romania has not changed one iota of our tiny little isolated weird Germanness here.
This is the beginning of a Hellboy movie where they tell you to get out of town before sunset.
Never seen a Hellboy movie.
Because who knows what happens to these Germans who have been in the mountains of Silesia or wherever it is for 750 years.
But also there was uranium in the Congo. And the Germans, and as part of their Indiana Jones adventures in Africa, also had this access to the uranium in the Congo. They did not have the money or the energy to be using gas diffusion or centrifuges to refine.
Sure as hell didn't have lasers. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, German space lasers, but they were all up in space.
I assume all our uranium was domestic, right? Like the Western U.S. has
a lot of uranium. Yeah, we're pulling uranium out of, and I bet you they have it in Canada too. One of the things, along with Joni Mitchell, that Canada has produced is a lot of rare earths.
A lot of people don't know this, but Joni Mitchell's song "Blue" is actually about Dr. Manhattan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's why it's called Blue.
Oh, Big Blue Penis Man, as I like to call him.
Yeah, BBPG.
So at the end of the war, right, we took all the German scientists and first of all put them in a big house and then imported them to the United States to do all of our nuke work and our space work.
Yeah.
But we dismantled all of their nuclear works, all of their science, really, that we could get our hands on, and imported it and used it.
Put it in big
as part of our science.
Put it in big Raiders of the Lost Ark crates.
That's right, and rolled it into warehouses.
Big chandeliers. Big
actually, that might actually be what happened here, because the uranium chandelier, and all the other raw material that the Germans had collected and refined at least enough that they had built these beautiful squares, cubes.
Beautiful, beautiful squares.
Beautiful, was, beautiful.
Was Kubert running
beautiful
the Nazi nuke program?
Yeah, they kind of look like Kubert's little ziggurat. All that stuff just kind of disappeared into Indiana Jones warehouses.
Because we've got that bureaucracy you love.
And the suspicion is most of that uranium just went into the U.S. stockpile of uranium that got centrifuged down into fissible material.
Our power plants in the 60s might have been running on Nazi uranium.
This is the thing. Our power plants and maybe some of our bombs that we were targeting at the Soviets.
You're running your Hoover vacuum cleaner, and it's not Third Reich electrons.
Right. The NS Savannah might have actually been tootling along on Nazi
cubes.
We talk about Nazi gold, but it's really the cubes that were running the show. But
it's all about the cubes.
But there wasn't any, at least in any of the records that are public, any sort of differentiation between the uranium they were pulling out of South Dakota and the uranium that they were.
And this probably wasn't even known at the time, right? The New York Times is not reporting on the whereabouts of Nazi uranium.
No,
right?
But it would have been known by the scientists,
yeah.
Because they're these beautiful little cubes. I mean,
they don't have like swastikas on them, right?
No.
Okay.
But there were over six.
How big are they?
They're 2 inches by 2 inches, so not huge. Okay. But
like
there were
a child's building block.
Yeah, a building block, right? A little number letter block.
Yeah.
But there were 664 of them. So a pretty big pile of these. And what's confusing to me is even if they didn't make two more, why the story wouldn't be that they had 666 of them? That would be so good on the Ancient Aliens show or the History Channel.
The History Channel would get a full miniseries out of this if it was 666.
Yeah, 666. And there probably were that many, and two of them fell off the pallet.
In some general's pocket.
Yeah. But recently, and the reason that this show was suggested to us
by Nicholas,
two of these cubes were recognized as potentially these Nazi cubes, two of them in American possession, one of them in a lab in Maryland, and one of them here in the Northwest at the Pacific Northwest research laboratories over in
Where's
Richland.
That? Okay.
Where we keep all of our nuke stuff because if it's going to poison anything, it should be the Columbia River.
I mean, they're not thinking that far ahead. You know, they're like, well, you know, Tri-Cities, nobody will miss. But right. you don't want to forget about the and Columbia River.
Can confirm that we wouldn't miss the Tri-Cities.
I mean, there's probably a Costco. I could probably like gas up at the Ellensburg Costco instead of the Kennewick one. I'd be okay.
In college at Gonzaga, I had one of probably the greatest professors I ever encountered in all of my school was a physics professor who would come up to Spokane to teach a couple of classes, who was a Hanford guy.
Yeah.
And he was a Hanford guy that at the time was old enough to have been part of that.
When was this?
Well, this would have been the 80s. So
he was still around, huh?
Yeah, and he was so clever and so engaging, and he obviously loved the physics so much. I have no idea how radioactive he was personally, but I loved him and loved that class so much that I really considered being a physicist, except for, of course, the math. If there was a way to leapfrog the math and just go right into like the theoretical physics, which all seemed like poetry to me.
I don't think that works.
But you had to have the math, unfortunately. But so these cubes just sort of recently came to light, and they are, they're both kind of just in jars. And I think the one here in Richland was used as sort of a training example of uranium to, you know, they would take it to like, TSA border guard
really?
Meetings and say like, here's, you know, we're going to put this in a bag.
See if you can find it.
See if you can detect it.
They're training dogs on it?
Yeah, training dogs on it. And a physicist, like a young physicist by the name of Brittany Robertson.
A lady physicist?
A lady physicist.
What a wonderful age we live
not
in.
Not only is she a lady physicist, she's an African-American lady physicist.
Now we're talking.
She said, hey, these seem to be Nazi cubes, but there's no swastikas on them. They're not like the Nazi gold that you would find in a right. suspenseful film.
They just match the size.
They match the size. And so she is now, so there were uranium cubes produced in two different labs, and one set of them were coated in styrene, and one set of them were coated in cyanide to keep them, puffing fresh.
I don't know if I would have chosen cyanide, but okay.
But she is in the process of examining these cubes because, of course, uranium decays at a measurable rate.
So she can tell their exact age.
Yeah, she can tell the age that because when they were initially made, they would have been almost 100% pure uranium. So to the degree that they have degraded into other elements, that will be how she knows when they were made.
She confirms.
And so we're right now living in a state of Heisenberg uncertainty state.
We're a cat in a box.
Where it's possible that we have evidence of Nazi uranium as part of the, because I think that these,
it doesn't seem like there's another option. Who else would be making 2-inch uranium cubes that somehow wind up in a government?
That's right.
Storehouse.
But you know how scientists are. They're very finicky about saying what something is until they have some proof. Weirdly, that's very out of fashion now. It's much more stylish to say things.
To call a magazine
and then find some proof, in your imagination.
I love that scientists are the last ones doing their homework.
Yeah, well, and I think that these cubes eventually, I think that they have kind of figured out that they came actually from the Department of Energy.
They don't know, it's funny, they don't have paperwork on this.
Yeah, right.
That doesn't give you a lot of trust in our institutions. We have some uranium, hard to say how much, when we got it, or why.
That's the thing about bureaucracy as it intersects with security
with weapons systems. Yeah.
Yeah, like who knows how many of these? It's possible, I think, that 662 of them are still sitting in a pile somewhere, but it doesn't seem likely.
Well, I love the idea that these could be the two extras that get you up to the number of the beast, right?
Whoa.
What if the 664, what if these two fell off a truck, somehow wound up in...
yeah, glass jars.
In Richland and Maryland, respectively.
Yeah, and these two labs. I think that's it.
And if you get the 666 together, you can do the incantation that brings back the old ones.
I feel like, in the spirit of our times, with no evidence whatsoever, we have unlocked the secret of these two cubes.
Give us a week-long show on History Channel, please. And that concludes Uranium Cubes, entry 1376.1K0710, certificate number 35410, in the omnibus. Now, futurelings, we plan on continuing the omnibus until every single corner of nuclear energy and the Third Reich has been delved. We were, even more problematically, we were on social media in the early 21st century.
Ugh.
At Ken Jennings and the at worst. John Roderick. It is funny just to watch Twitter get worse every day.
It's been so long since I've been on Twitter, but I have been going on Blue Sky and Threads to see if there's anything there. So far,
Threads is bad, but Blue Sky is a nice little village.
Yeah, Blue Sky seems more fun. I went on Threads and immediately had that familiar feeling of there are just a lot of people on here trading in righteous statements about something or another that either I agree with or don't, but I don't want to hear some random talk about. Like, I don't care what you think about Columbus Day, random person. Like, why is this here? Why is this in my life?
Blue Sky seems to have more of the kind of absurdist jokes that were really the only reason ever to be on any of these things.
But most of what I see on, at least on Threads, is people talking about the death of Twitter. I'm like, the last thing I care about is why you're here.
Somebody said Blue Sky will not catch on until, only a third of the posts are about Twitter. So it's unclear where At Omnibus Project will find itself on social media, but...
you can find it. I mean...
But what's our destiny? Is there ever going to be a stable Instagram that we land on? Who knows?
You are my density.
But you can always find the Futurelings.
Maybe BBS. Let's
start a little bulletin board service. Let's start a blog, John. The Futurelings are on Facebook. There's a cool Discord that's trying, to do a transcript of the entire project for reasons that aren't clear to me. So let's make it hard on them. You can also...
I got that reference.
I think they have... Don't they have a...
Who?
There's a Discord. There's a subreddit. That's what it is. I think there's a Futurelings subreddit.
Did you ever spend any time on Reddit? Because I could never make any sense of the interface. Like, I'm not sure what's happening.
There. Okay, boomer.
Yeah, it's just like, what am I?
Actually, the search interface is not great.
No.
You put in a search term and it tells you, oh, here are some subreddits that have that in the name. And you actually have to scroll down and be like, no, I was actually searching for that thing. And then they say, okay, here's results for that in the subreddit where you were. Or do you want other things from all over Reddit?
See, lame.
It's pretty pernicious.
What I like about 4chan is that it's an image board. What I don't like about it is all the images, but at least there's a picture to start with. Like, oh, look at this. It's a dismembered child.
I hate all the images, and they actually make everyone a worse person.
But as a boomer...
At least they have images.
Yeah, I do get to see a picture that explains at least what this post is purportedly about.
If you're a boomer who likes images, have you considered just watching... broadcast TV and infomercials all day? I mean, it's that's what my grandpa did.
Maybe. I just need to get the rabbit ears so they pick up the NPR.
Then you could watch Jeopardy, too.
No, thanks. I'm not that old.
Let's see. My friend texted me the other day and said, you know, I'm with my mom at her assisted care facility in what's south of L.A. there? Something Beach.
Cannon Beach. No, that's in Oregon.
Somewhere in Orange County. And he says, and really until I spent some time with my mom and her friends, I had no idea how important, Ken, your job is to a certain stratum of Americans.
You keep old people from rioting.
They could not go to bed without you. They would not know what time their soup gets cold. And I said, it's true. I go to bed with your mom and all her friends every night.
Lol.
And he was roasted, basically.
Basically, totally.
I don't know how he comes back
from
that one.
Boom. Scorched.
The blah, blah, blah. You could send us email at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You could send us physical objects. Send us uranium through the mail. It's probably legal?
I think it's not. I 100% believe that there are people listening to the show that have uranium in their house.
There's five boxes you have to check to say, no, this is not inflammable. No, this is not pornography. I'm sure one of them is radioactive, right?
Yeah, well, Americans cannot send uranium overseas. I know that. So if you had a friend in the Netherlands.
I know from experience.
And you're like, I made a little doll of you out of uranium.
Hey, Willem.
You cannot send it to them. But whether or not
What an odd hypothetical, John.
Whether you wrapped it in like a lead mitten.
Yeah.
I don't know. Beats me.
And just don't check the box where you're like, hey, Mr. Postmaster, I'm sending fissionable materials.
I mean, if you can send anthrax through the mail.
Yeah, that's legal. Famously. Please do not send us anthrax, but do send uranium to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. But the best way to support the show is not to send us transuranic elements, but rather to send us a small amount of currency, just relative to the amount you appreciate the show and the difference it makes in your week. Because without that, it'll be gone and you'll have to switch to the dollop and you'll feel sad.
Please do not switch to the dollop. Those ding-dongs don't need your money.
I have nothing against the dollop. Why are you always doing this?
Why am I against the dollop?
Yeah.
Well, one of the hosts of the dollop was early on a friend of mine, a Twitter friend, and we actually knew each other in person. Not because we would have known each other in person, but we sought each other out
Because of Twitter.
Yeah, in the early days, and of course, the times were such that there were only 600 people on all of Twitter, but Dave Anthony and I socialized quite a bit and email corresponded and he was here in Seattle and we went to an international house of pancakes together one time, having a good old time with one another. And he said, and this was when I had one podcast, my legendary podcast, Roderick on the Line. And he said, you know what I don't like? I don't like all these podcasts where it's just two people talking. He said, I come from radio, and
it's got to be one guy carrying that thread for 6 hours.
Well, and you've got to have production. You've got to be, you've got to have it be a tight 30 or whatever.
I see.
And he was giving me a lecture about how, like, podcasting was a lazy man's thing unless you used NPR level production to make a legit thing.
Only Ira Glass has the only podcast.
And I said, Dave, you're describing my podcast, which is me just talking to my friend at length about nothing. And he rolled his eyes at me and said, yeah, you're the problem.
Yeah, I love how his idea of American terrestrial radio, famously that tight, tight form that never has any rambling or filler.
And that is not to say that he and I didn't remain friends, but I became a podcast enemy of his because he was denigrating the very thing that put bread and put white bread and refined salt and bratwurst on my plate.
Doesn't he have a very prominent white guys rambling podcast?
I don't know, who cares anymore. I mean, that was in 2012. I mean, I don't know what anybody does anymore.
We'll go to Patreon.
Don't send your money to the dollop. Send it to us. You know, what a little bit of money is pretty relative, right? When was the last time you spent $20 on dinner? Every single day.
It's very hard to get dinner in Seattle for $20 anymore.
Yeah, you can't, right? Whereas you could send us $20 a month. It's less than a dinner.
It would put you in one of the higher donation tiers. You'd hear a bonus addenda show every month.
You could suggest cubes at us. That really feels like a suggestion at me.
That's a higher. You think it was aggressive?
A little bit, like, yeah. Hey, what do you think? Nazi cubes
at the higher levels, like Nicholas did. You could suggest a topic, and John has to dance.
That's
John,
right.
Has to be your little monkey and talk about uranium for however long this has been.
I'll talk about your uranium.
I'll talk about your mom's uranium.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, the catastrophe being people listening to the dollop. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and uranium. We hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Ark.